Speed economic expert. Dennison, our final question to you. USAID's embrace of the private sector has set disastrous precedents over the years, where the win of the private sector was often built on the losses of the people that it was supposed to help. Tell us what that exactly means.
Okay. One of the companies that did that was Bechtel, for example. And it's important to note that George Shultz, who was very involved with Bechtel, now recently deceased, former Secretary of State of the United States, together with a couple of other individuals, enacted something in the early 2000s called a revolution in military affairs. It was an American revolution. It wasn't just technology like cyber warfare and all that kind of thing. It was a way in which you created a circumstance where warfare became a form of competition. There's a document that just came out in the United States called the Army and Military Competition Chief of Staff Paper Number 2. And it says, war, in fact, is just one form of competition in a continuum of competitions. Military activities during competition can be defensive or offensive, lethal or non-lethal, etc. It goes on like that. It says war is a form of competition. First of all, that means you're not even trying to win a war. You're trying to perpetuate warfare. And what we're beginning to, and we've been seeing this, it's really a British model, perpetual warfare policy, which will be familiar to people that remember the period of the Persian-British Wars of the 1840s or other such things back then, 56, 57, when in fact the border of present-day Iran was created by the British looting then Persia. And that's the kind of policy that, unfortunately, from the time of the Kuwait policy back in 1990-91 until this very day, that the United States has also elected to pursue a kind of Anglo-American self-destroying policy, and all imperial policies ultimately fail. You have had a problem with a shift in U.S. policy over the past 20 years, particularly since the year 2000. Prior to that time, at least there was a legacy of the earlier JFK approach to aid, which was at least an honest approach. But this then shifted, particularly at the time of the 9/11, post-9/11 era. So now what you have is a kind of combination of things, whether it's food as a weapon as a policy, in a different way, medicines as a weapon. It's not really entirely an American policy. It's a policy, it's a sort of more like a transatlantic world policy, first really initiated after the fall of the Berlin Wall and then the collapse of the Soviet Union in that period of 1989 to 91 when the neocons first came to power, the Project for a New American Century and so on. And that outlook has shaped policy. You can see that outlook in people like Mike Pompeo, for example, who represented that. So it's been completely continuous from 1990, 91 under the George Bush 41 administration up until today. It's disastrous. And is not working in the interest of the American people or the people that is apparently supposed to help.
All right. Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That's economic expert Dennis Speed there. Well, it's time now to take a look at our final report in this week's program, where we take a look at two instances of U.S. interference, in this case against Russia, one that happened within Russia, and the other in Georgia, where former Vice President Dick Cheney actually visited Georgina troops while promising aid and democracy, U.S. style, to the country. It's time now for our in-depth section. First, imagine poor country is recovering from a long war and struggling to meet the basic needs of its citizens. Now, the rich country steps up and offers to help the poor country. Rich country figures it's not just an ethical thing to do, but also a smart political move. Sounds good so far. But what if the way in which rich country helps the poor country is by partnering with the world's most powerful corporations to develop the war-torn nation? Well, in return for the corporation's apparent benevolence, rich country then uses its power to remove all the roadblocks the corporations might face in doing business in poor country. Now, the corporations are free to do business as they please, and, well, they make huge profits out of the resource-rich parts of poor country, and they even continue practices for which they would face criticism in the rich country. Well, this is while poor country continues to struggle to meet the basic needs of its citizens, except now it has the added burden of being indebted to the rich country and its corporations. So we ask, is this ethical? You're probably wondering who, after all, is getting helped in all of this. The whole theme of the topic of this show leaves one to think, what moral ground does the U.S. stand on? Or any country, for that matter, which uses aid as a tool to help countries with aid to make a profit from the suffering of poor countries, with profits of, in this case, U.S. corporations in mind, is just morally wrong. But morality does not play into U.S. politics. For example, there's nothing morally acceptable about U.S. sanctions when it is known to cause deaths, like right here in Iran. USAID's embrace of the private sector goes against the very moral premise on which it was founded. Helping corporations who have a dangerous history of using their power to twist the arms of government to the detriment of its citizens, it just shouldn't happen, especially if the countries that are suffering are due to the U.S. warmongering policies, and there are quite a few of those countries around. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. From Mika Vitale and the entire team, it's goodbye until the next program.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, and one Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Iran is the land of poetry and literature. Great renowned poets lived in this vast land, which among them mention can be made of Maulana, Saadi, Hafez, and Khayyam. One of the great Iranian poets is Baba Taher Oryan. Today I'm going to travel to the old city of Hamedan in order to visit the tomb of this great Iranian poet. The tomb of Baba Taher is located in the city of Hamedan, in a square with the same name in Baba Taher Square. Baba Taher, who lived in late 4th century AH and early 5th century AH, is one of the great poets and mystics of Iran. He is the master of couplet composing poets of Iran. The tomb of Baba Taher is located in the city of Hamedan in the center of a green, beautiful, rectangular square. This tomb has a prism-shaped dome, which is turquoise in color. The tower of the tomb is located on an octagonal base. The old tomb of Baba Taher dates back to the Seljuqid era. The new tomb was renovated in 1965. I am now in the ancient, beautiful city of Hamedan. The magnificent tower of Baba Taher is across from me. I really can't wait to see the inner part of this beautiful tomb. Well, the facade of the structure which houses the tomb is made of stone. These beautiful stones have been taken from the mountains around Hamedan and have been used for building this tomb. Around me, there is a green beautiful area which I can't take my eyes off it. The building of the tomb is located on a hill. Let's go inside the building. Oh my God! Magnificent! Amazing! Extraordinary! I am now inside the area of the Baba Taher tomb. Around me there are marble-made inscriptions. 24 pieces of marble which have Baba Taher couplets written on them with beautiful Farsi language and calligraphy. These couplets are very emotional and fill one with serenity and calm. One of these inscriptions reads, "Love to be sweet must be reciprocal. Love unrequited makes sick the heart." Thank you. and the area around the tomb is so beautiful. This area is filled with colorful, fragrant flowers. People of the heart usually visit this tomb and recite the poems of this great poet.
من از حال و بلا تشویش دارم، گناه از برگ و بارون بیش دارم، اگر لا تقن تو دستم نگیره، من از یا ویلنا اندیش دارم.
Let me walk in this beautiful area. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The United States under President Joe Biden has taken a tougher stance against Russia. On Thursday, Biden said Washington is facing a national emergency, accusing Russia of interference in the 2020 U.S. presidential election and involvement in a major cyber espionage operation. Biden signed an executive order imposing sweeping sanctions against several Russian individuals and institutions, requiring the Treasury Department to block U.S. financial institutions from purchasing bonds from the Central Bank of the Russian Federation, the National Wealth Fund of the Russian Federation, or the Ministry of Finance of the Russian Federation after June 14, and from lending funds to these institutions. Also, the U.S. said it's expelling 10 personnel from Russia's diplomatic mission, claiming that some of them are representatives of intelligence services. But at the same time, the U.S. president called for de-escalation with Russia.
The way forward is through thoughtful dialogue and diplomatic process. The U.S. is prepared to continue constructively to move toward that process. My bottom line is this. Where there's an interest in the United States to work with Russia, we should and we will. If Russia seeks to violate the interests of the United States, we will respond.
Shortly after the announcement, the North Atlantic Council, the political decision-making body within NATO, released a statement in support of the U.S. measures.
Well, it seems to me that it's more appropriate, and probably has been done, for the Russians to declare a national emergency, because they are the ones that are threatened, not the U.S. The U.S. is intervening in a crisis which it helped to create through the support given during the Obama years to the color revolution in Ukraine, which was directed primarily against Russia on behalf of the Western intelligence forces, who felt, in the words of Brzezinski, that if Russia loses Ukraine, they become very weak.
The developments come amid heightened tensions in eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian forces and the Ukrainian military have clashed in recent weeks. Moscow said it will ban a string of top officials from U.S. President Joe Biden's administration, including his chief domestic policy advisor, Susan Rice, from entering Russia. The Russian Foreign Ministry said U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland, FBI Chief Christopher Wray, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, and several other officials will be barred. The ministry said the officials participated in the anti-Russian push of the U.S. politics. The U.S. ambassador to Moscow is also being asked to leave the country.
President Vladimir Putin's top foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, has recommended that U.S. envoy John Sullivan leave for Washington to conduct serious consultations.
Lavrov said Russia would ask 10 U.S. diplomats to leave the country in a tit-for-tat move. He said the activity of American funds and NGOs in Russia that interfere in the country's internal affairs would also be ceased. Lavrov added that Moscow is also considering, quote, painful measures against U.S. businesses in Russia.
The policy as it's now formed is aimed at really reducing Russia as a major power. They're doing it primarily economically, but also I think what they want is they will not accept a Russia led by Vladimir Putin, but they want regime change. So it's really to create a world in which the United States sets the rules.
It appears that the U.S. and Russia are heading towards another Cold War. The possible crisis, however, could prove even costlier than the first for both sides.
The war in Afghanistan has been a major foreign policy challenge for several U.S. presidents. The war, which began in 2001 under former President George W. Bush, has killed some 2,300 U.S. troops and cost American taxpayers more than $2 trillion. The protracted conflict has been widely described as futile. This week, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that America will finally withdraw all of its forces from Afghanistan in 2021.
After consulting closely with our allies and partners, with our military leaders and intelligence personnel, with our diplomats and our development experts, with the Congress and the Vice President, as well as with Mr. Ghani and many others around the world, I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
Several thousand American forces remain part of the 9,600-strong NATO mission there. Under Biden's plan, the withdrawal is scheduled to begin on May the 1st and will be completed in September. The U.S. president seems confident about his withdrawal plan, but his initiative has been met with criticism. The Taliban called for the U.S. to abide by an agreement with the group, which was brokered in Doha, Qatar, last year. The U.S. under former President Donald Trump had agreed to pull out all troops from Afghanistan by May the 1st. The militant group warned that if the Doha agreement is breached, those who fail to comply with the deal will be held responsible for any possible problems. Russia's foreign ministry also said the newly announced withdrawal strategy violates America's previous promises. Meanwhile, the pullout plan comes at a time when Taliban militants are in control of large parts of Afghanistan after nearly two decades of the U.S.-led war against them. The almost 20-year war has wreaked havoc in Afghanistan and claimed tens of thousands of lives. Taliban militants who were forced out of power by the U.S. invasion in 2001 proved resilient and clawed back large parts of Afghanistan from foreign and government forces, especially in recent years. They are now in control of important parts of the country. They seem to be an indispensable part of Afghanistan's future. Critics of America's foreign policy say this exposes the futility of U.S. militarism in the region.
I believe that this conflict, when you analyze it, the only proper way to state it is that it was a total failure. The United States will try to spin this into a complicated story, into saying, you know, it's complicated, nobody, there are no clear winners. But you think about the fact that they did the same similar thing even in Vietnam, when the Americans were dealt a sound crushing defeat.
The U.S.-led military campaign failed to wipe out militancy. It instead devastated Afghanistan and has left the country grappling with a long list of problems such as poverty, unemployment, and illicit opium production. Some even go so far as to call war-torn Afghanistan a failed state. Meanwhile, the insecurity has provided a fertile ground for the growth of militant groups more extreme than the Taliban. Now foreign forces are finally planning to leave. Who is responsible for the mess that they're leaving behind? It's the Afghan people who have to put up with the unending misery every day. The departure of foreign forces this year could mark a new chapter for Afghans. Observers believe Afghans across the country, whether in the ranks of the Taliban or the government, have to put aside their differences and work together if they really want a future for their country.
Tensions are running high between Moscow and Kiev over the latest escalation in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. NATO has expressed concern over Russia's military buildup in the area.
We are seriously concerned by ongoing developments, and NATO is monitoring the situation very closely.
NATO's chief said Russia's move is unjustified. He called on Moscow to end the buildup in and around Ukraine and stop what he called its provocations and de-escalate immediately. Ukraine has also called for sanctions on Russia over the measure.
We need measures which will deter Russia and which will contain its aggressive intentions. This could be, as the Secretary General mentioned, a new round of sanctions which would raise the price of Russian aggression.
Russia, however, has its own argument and has warned against what it calls fueling belligerent sentiment in Ukraine. Moscow accuses the U.S. and other NATO members of turning Ukraine into a, quote, a powder keg by increasing arms supplies to Kiev. It says the military support is a serious challenge to Russia, adding that Moscow would do everything possible to ensure its security. But what is Russia-Ukraine tension all about? A few weeks ago, Moscow deployed troops along the border with Ukraine following reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces in Donbass. Moscow accused Kiev of taking provocative measures near its border. In return, Ukraine, the U.S. and NATO accused Russia of sending troops and heavy weaponry to prop up militias in eastern Ukraine. But the Kremlin says there is nothing to fear, describing the repositioning of Russian armed units as a domestic issue. The tension between Russia and Ukraine has drawn reactions from other countries. In a meeting with his Ukrainian counterpart in Brussels, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called Russia's military buildup very provocative.
The United States stands firmly behind the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine, and I'm here to reaffirm that with the foreign minister today. And that's particularly important at a time when we're seeing, unfortunately, Russia take very provocative actions.
Blinken had warned that if Russia acts recklessly or aggressively, there will be consequences. France and Germany have also called on Russia to halt a troop buildup on the border with Ukraine and reaffirm their support for Kiev in its confrontation with Moscow. Meanwhile, foreign ministers of the G7 countries have issued a joint statement calling the movement of Russian troops near the border with Ukraine threatening and destabilizing. But Turkey, a NATO member, had a different stance. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Ankara was working to end the Ukraine-Russia tension while voicing military cooperation and support for Ukraine.
This is a very serious issue. And it seems like escalation comes from Ukrainian and NATO side. For some reason, I suspect the new Biden administration, they want to test Russia and Putin's resolve. Maybe they have a feeling that they can push the situation further. But it's a very kind of naive hope. Basically, what everybody has to be aware that East Ukraine doesn't want to go back. They don't want to obey Kiev. They want to be either on their own or join Russia if that works out. They don't want to be part of Ukraine.
Many believe that the U.S. decision to send warships to the volatile area would complicate the situation.
That's exactly what it is. I think United States want to test Russia. They also, it's for United States, we have to be aware that we have a change of scenery. Many people who were in State Department and the government who were ousted under Trump, they came back. And they want to resurrect their failed policy vis-a-vis Ukraine. They started the whole thing. They started, this campaign of splitting Ukraine apart, pulling it toward, NATO. So they think that they can, try it. And if, you know, while trying it, they are testing, you know, Putin's resolve, Russian resolve. They also don't have much to lose. It's not their soldiers who are going to get killed there. It'll be either Eastern Ukrainians or you know, Kiev forces will be killed. And then it'll be like the usual scenario, usual script, which we very well know. No matter what happens, Russia will be blamed, new sanctions will be introduced, and among the sanctions, you know, United States love to do the sanctions.
With tensions simmering in eastern Ukraine, U.S. media are happy to push the narrative that Russia is the aggressor and is preparing to invade its neighbor. The reports ignore the fact that the Donetsk and Luhansk republics in eastern Donbass region declared independence from Ukraine back in 2014 in response to a U.S.-backed coup. It seems that the United States, along with its longtime ally NATO, are establishing a united front against Russia. What is certain, however, is that such escalations risk spiraling out of control and sucking all sides into a vortex that would be in no one's favor. It was on Sunday when Iran's nuclear facilities in the central city of Natanz came under another Israeli attack. Israeli media cited intelligence sources as saying it was an Israeli cyber attack. Former Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Moshe Yalon said he hopes no one in Israel would take responsibility for the Natanz incident implicitly. Yalon said there are things for which silence is always beautiful. Spokesman for Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Behrouz Kamalvandi, said the incident affected part of the electricity distribution network of Natanz. He said the attack caused no casualties or contamination, adding that investigations are underway into the matter. Iran's nuclear chief also reacted. Ali Akbar Salehi condemned the incident as an act of nuclear terrorism. He said the futile and desperate enemy move was aimed at blocking Iran's eye-catching nuclear progress. He called on the international community and the International Atomic Energy Agency to respond to the act of terror. Iran's foreign ministry also accused Israel of being the culprit behind the cyber attack on the Natanz nuclear facility, pledging that Tehran will take revenge. Foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh slammed the Israeli sabotage act as an act of nuclear terrorism.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. There has been no casualty or contamination reported, but it could very much resulted in a catastrophic situation. So it can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity.
Khatibzadeh said Iran reserves the right to respond in kind under Article 51 of the UN Charter. The spokesman noted that Tehran has started communications with international authorities in this regard. Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident at Natanz will not slow down Iran's nuclear program and will instead speed up the country's nuclear advancement. He said the centrifuges damaged in the incident were the IR-1 type and that they will be replaced with the most advanced centrifuges Iran has developed. The attack on the Natanz nuclear facility happens on the same day the U.S. Defense Secretary visits Israel for the first time in his capacity.
As a major strategic partner for the United States, our bilateral relationship with Israel in particular is central to regional stability and security in the Middle East. During our meeting, I reaffirmed to Minister Gantz, our commitment to Israel is enduring and it is ironclad.
For many, the visit might be carrying a message.
One has to assume, especially while the defense secretary is visiting Israel, because it would be hugely embarrassing. So the assumption has to be that the U.S. knew this attack was going to take place and did not say not to do it. Otherwise, there would have to be some kind of a protest by the United States to the Israeli government for doing it.
The attack on Natanz nuclear facility is not the first act of terror by the Israeli regime against the Islamic Republic. A blast hit a centrifuge assembly line at Natanz July last year, which Iran described as an act of sabotage. Head of the Israeli agency Yossi Cohen told the New York Times then that Israel had detonated a bomb there. In November 2020, prominent nuclear physicist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated in a terrorist attack near the Iranian capital Tehran. this as his name, was mentioned multiple times in a presentation in 2018 by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during which he repeated baseless claims about the Iranian nuclear energy program. Netanyahu described the scientist as the director of Iran's nuclear program and threatened, quote, remember that name, Fakhrizadeh. Apart from Fakhrizadeh, a number of other Iranian scientists have fallen victim to the Israeli terrorism. Ardashir Hosseinpour, Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Daryush Rezai-Nejad, Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan are all on that list. But as far as the Natanz attack is concerned, it came a day after Iran started off several cascades of advanced centrifuges in the facility. The incident also comes at a time when Tehran is holding talks with the remaining signatories to the Iran nuclear deal in the Austrian capital Vienna. The negotiations are aimed at removing the U.S. sanctions on the Islamic Republic.
Well, for Israel to do it at this time, the assumption, again, would be that they're trying to mess up those negotiations and make it hard for the United States to come to an agreement with Iran. It'll be harder for the U.S., I imagine, to go back by taking off the sanctions.
All in all, what is almost certain is the fact that Israel will leave no stone unturned to hamper Iran's nuclear advancements by carrying out such acts of terrorism. The regime also tries its best to prevent the United States from reaching a deal with the Islamic Republic to remove the sanctions that have crippled the lives of millions of Iranians. But many are also pointing the finger at the U.S. in the case of the Natanz Sabotage Act and other terrorist attacks by the Israeli regime, arguing Israel doesn't commit such acts of terror without Washington's blessing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
the vast majority of land on Earth, a shocking 97%, that is home to millions of species, is no longer qualified as ecologically intact, and humans are to blame, a new study reveals. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading 97% of Earth's land no longer ecologically intact, study finds. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Ecologists and environmental advocates called for swift action to reintroduce species into the wild, as scientists at the University of Cambridge in England found that 97% of the planet's land area no longer qualifies as ecologically intact. Conservation is simply not enough anymore, said activist Ben Goldsmith. We need restoration. The authors of the study, published in the journal Frontiers in Forest and Global Change, expressed alarm at their findings, which showed that of the 3% of fully intact land, much lies in northern areas which weren't rich in biodiversity to begin with, such as boreal forest in Canada or tundra in Greenland. The amount of ecologically intact land was much lower than we were expecting, Dr. Andrew Plantre, head of the Key Biodiversity Areas Secretariat at Cambridge and lead author of the study, told Science News. Going in, I'm guessed that it would be 8 to 10%, he added. It just shows how huge an impact we'd had. The researchers examined whether natural habitats had retained the number of species which were present in the year 1500, the standard used by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature to assess species extinction. Earlier research using satellite imagery led to estimates that 20 to 40% of the planet had retained its natural biodiversity. But areas including dense forest, which can appear intact from above, were found to be missing numerous species. The researchers linked the loss of unscathed land to hunting and other destructive human activities, disease, and the impact of invasive species. According to The Guardian, the study may underestimate the intact regions because it does not take account of the impacts of the climate crisis, which is changing the ranges of species. Only 11% of land still considered intact was found to be in officially protected areas, but much of the intact regions coincide with territories managed by indigenous communities, who have played a vital role in maintaining the ecological integrity of these areas, the researchers wrote. In light of the study, advocates, including author George Monbiot and ecologist Alan Watson, called for rewilding or species reintroduction in affected areas. The reintroduction of up to 5 species could help restore 20% of the planet to previous levels of biodiversity, the study found. Examples would include reintroducing forest elephants in areas of Congo Basin where they have been extirpated, or reintroducing some of the large ungulates that have been lost from much of Africa's woodlands and savannas because of overhunting, that is, buffalo, giraffe, zebras, etc., as long as overhunting has ceased, the researchers wrote. Previously, the rewilding of gray wolves in Yellowstone National Park in the U.S. led to a resurgence in the park's ecosystem. More than 30 years ago, wilderness areas, natural areas that have not been considerably modified by humans, were identified as priorities of conservation and protection actions. Only recently has there been a push to define how to measure wilderness, with a focus on intact habitats. The integrity of natural ecosystems has also been recognized by the UN Convention on Biological Diversity as an important goal in the post-2020 Global Biodiversity Framework. Currently, there is no common definition of intactness. Past assessments, which focused on mapping human influence on habitat intactness, created maps of anthropogenic impact that independently estimated that between 20% and 40% of the planet's terrestrial surface remains free from major human disturbance, such as human settlements, roads, and light and noise pollution. In the new study, Plumbre and colleagues took a different approach. Instead of focusing on human impact, they made a scoping of key biodiversity areas, KBA criterion sea sites, which states that an intact ecological community has the full complement of species known to occur in a particular site in their natural abundances. That is, no one knows of the loss of animals in that area relative to a regionally appropriate benchmark. As a benchmark, the authors chose the year 1500 CE, as this is the baseline date for assessing species extinctions within the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. In addition to habitat intactness, the authors also assessed faunal intactness, that is, without any loss of animal species, and functional intactness, no loss of animal densities below a level that would affect the healthy functioning of an ecosystem.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on the blessed month of Ramadan.
Fasting is the greatest blessing of Ramadan. The hardships that exist in Ramadan celebration, the hardships that one endures because of fasting and hunger, are perhaps the greatest achievement of this divine celebration. fasting has such a large number of blessings in terms of the spirituality and enlightenment that it bestows on one's heart that perhaps it can be said it is the greatest blessing of this month. A number of people fast, and thus these people have joined in the celebration and they have benefited from it. But as well as fasting, these people follow Quranic teachings in a perfect manner. They think deeply when they read the Holy Quran. Reading the Holy Quran at nights and at midnights, developing a close relationship with it and being addressed by God while one is fasting or while one is enlightened as a result of fasting gives one a special kind of pleasure and it has a special significance. The thing that one obtains out of such reading of the Holy Quran cannot be obtained in normal conditions.
فيك الحب زاد عم العباد يا خير زاد رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان ليتك دوما قريب
During Ramadan, people are invited to a divine celebration. In the sermon which was referred to, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "This is a month in which you have been invited to a divine celebration." One should think deeply about this sentence. It says that we have been invited to a divine celebration. It is not obligatory for all people to benefit from this divine celebration. No, it has been made a faridah. We have the power to choose whether or not to benefit from the celebration. There are some people who do not at all find the opportunity to pay attention to this invitation. They are so ignorant and they pay such careful attention to materialistic issues and the materialistic world that they do not notice when the month of Ramadan arrives and when it ends. They are like the people who are invited to an impressive and blessed celebration, but they do not have time to take part in it, and they do not even look at the invitation card. These people deprive themselves of all the blessings.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the World with Reporters.
The seventh holy month of Ramadan since the start of the war on Yemen has arrived, and Yemeni's struggle continues. The rising cost of living makes shopping for essentials a difficult task, as most Yemenis depend on daily wages.
We're going through a harsh economic condition. The ongoing blockade and war imposed by the Saudi-led coalition have put us in deep troubles. We hardly earn our livelihood and can't afford to buy food for Ramadan.
Tradesmen say they didn't earn much this year due to severe fuel crisis that led to the rising of prices of foodstuffs. Meanwhile, deteriorating economic condition has forced many companies to discharge thousands of their employees.
The purchasing power of people in Yemen has weakened significantly. The prices are rising because the Saudi-led coalition is still preventing entry of oil ships to Yemen. We are suffering greatly from the ongoing war and blockade.
Yemen is on the brink of famine and facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, since Saudi-led coalition backed by Washington launched a devastating war on the war-ravaged nation at the beginning of 2015.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation in their country, Yemenis welcome Ramadan with hopes of an end to war. They say their army's escalation of retaliatory attacks is pushing Riyadh further into a political solution. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The United Arab Emirates has sparked anger among Palestinians by congratulating Israel on its so-called Independence Day, declared in 1948. The occasion is marked by Palestinians as the beginning of their displacement from their homeland. They view the day as the Nakba or Catastrophe Day.
What Israelis are marking is the day of our catastrophe, the day Palestinians were slaughtered by Zionist gangs. Hundreds of thousands of them were displaced from their homes and lands. The UAE should have sent a message to condemn the daily crimes and oppression committed by the Israeli soldiers as settlers against the Palestinians.
The UAE Embassy in Tel Aviv published a tweet wishing a happy Independence Day to the citizens of Israel, posting a photo of the Israeli and Emirati flags side by side. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu replied by thanking the UAE.
The UAE has not only normalized ties with Israel, but also raised the ties to a new level. The UAE is also becoming Israel's partner in its aggression against the Palestinian people. The congratulation message comes as Israel is preventing Palestinians from entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The UAE was among the first Arab countries to agree to normalize ties with Israel in 2020 under the so-called Abraham Accords, a pact brokered by former U.S. President Donald Trump. Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan signed normalization deals with the Israeli regime shortly afterwards. Palestinians have angrily slammed normalization of ties between Israel and Arab states, including UAE. They say that since then, those states have been continuing to reward the regime and giving up the Holy Lands. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Iran's lead nuclear negotiator in Vienna, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says a new understanding is being reached amid attempts to revive the Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Following a joint commission session with JCPOA signatories, Russia, China, Britain, France and Germany, Araghchi said negotiators can now start working on a common draft.
Drafting can begin at least in the areas where the sides share the same views. For that purpose, the Iranian delegation has prepared its drafts both on the nuclear measures and sanction lifting, and has presented its drafts to the other parties.